The countdown is on to fight time. This is Big Fight Weekend. Now, here is your host, TJ Reeves.
Well, hello there and welcome in. Believe it or not, when I say this, we are headed to the final weekend of March already, and we got fights all over the place, including an intriguing pay-per-view in Las Vegas between David Benavidez and Caleb Plant to go over. It is the Big Fight Weekend Preview Podcast. I am the somewhat capable host. He is our insider from his Fight Freaks Unite Substack and from BigFightWeekend.com, the website. Hello, Dan Rafael. And not only do we have fights, but you have a Q&A. Once again, second week in a row, a Q&A that the fans are going to be interested in. And not just some guy, some fighter, whomever. No, no. We go top shelf with you, Anthony Joshua, AJ, on the podcast coming up in a little bit. And the story about how you got the interview, they want to stay tuned for. First of all, how are you feeling as we head towards the weekend here?
I'm good. To coin the name of the website, it's a Big Fight Weekend.
It is.
I'm looking forward to it. We're going to talk about Benavidez and Plant. Good fight, good card. Got ESPN action with Jose Ramirez back in the ring. We got some good fights to talk about, like with Joshua and other things in the future. And it's a spring day here in Northern Virginia. I couldn't be happier.
Yeah, you got a little warm weather there. We've been getting some warm weather in Florida. We got the March Madness still going on with the basketball, so we're keeping track of all of this. But the boxing, even in the UK, where Lawrence Okoli is defending his cruiserweight title, and I know we got a lot of fans in the UK that listen to us as well. So we cover all that we can here on this here preview podcast, usually out overnight Thursday into Friday, depending on when you're hearing it in the preview mode. We come off the weekend with the recap podcast. The Fight Freaks Unite recap comes your way overnight, usually Sunday into Monday, depending. We're pretty dependable right now into the weekend and out of the weekend with a preview and a recap, and they want to make sure they're following or subscribing right here on this podcast feed. The growth has continued. And if you follow or subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, you also automatically find out about different things, like when we put the David Benavidez interview up that you had during last week's podcast. We put that up as a solo conversation, you and he, as a separate thing. They needed no other prompt from social media or your Substack or anything else to know that it was there, because what did they get, Dan Rafael, if they're following or subscribing?
Oh, we know this. They get a banner, a bell, a ding, a vibration, a light. You know how it goes.
Something that told them Big Dan and David Benavidez, who was not holding back, by the way, that's on the podcast feed immediately before us here, to hear that one-on-one as he gets ready to fight Caleb Plant in a 12-rounder for the WBC interim super middleweight title that Benavidez currently holds. We'll get into that fight in a moment. Anthony Joshua coming up as well. But before we get there, I have to share this with the audience, because one of the common compliments that we get is that you and I get a little more, we get heated sometimes back and forth with discussions. It's all good. But we also get a little more involved personally in what's going on. So you've been telling me this for days, and I'm like, this has got to be on the podcast. So let's pull the curtain back a little bit on the personal life of Dan Rafael, because you're juggling professionally. I'm trying to interview Anthony Joshua, but you're juggling it with your son who's in elementary school and a play. All right, I've set the stage. Hey, there's a theatrical reference. Pick it up from there on how this went, because I keep saying to you, you got to tell the story on the podcast. Go.
I don't want you to oversell us. I mean, I didn't realize we were going to necessarily talk about
but this. This is great stuff because it involves you trying to interview the former unified heavyweight champion of the world while this is going on. Go.
Two-time former unified heavyweight champion of the world. But so anyway, so I was arranging an interview with Anthony Joshua through the PR team at DAZN, who was coordinating his media. He wasn't doing a lot of interviews. I have a good rapport with Joshua. I've covered him before. I've met him several times. I've interviewed him a number of times. So we get on well. He was cool. He wanted to do the interviews. So, okay, great. So I'm going back and forth. Okay, they tell me he's going to be available on Tuesday. He's got a window of like an hour where he's going to be doing interviews. So, you know, how are you for that time? I forget what the time exactly was. It was like between.
And we should mention they're 5 hours ahead in England, right? Or was he training here in the United States? But he was in England.
He, By the time we were doing the interview, he was already back in London.
Okay, so we're dealing with a time, we're dealing with a time difference, and that's critical. Yes. Go ahead.
4 hours at the moment until they change their clocks in the UK. So at the moment, it's a 4 hour difference between the United States East Coast and London. In any event, so his window, he was going to be doing interviews between 3 and 4 p.m. Eastern time. Now I know, as I realized when they told me the time, then they told me the hour, and then they told me my exact time. Which was like, they hadn't given me the exact time, but it was going to be at the tail end of that. And I'm like, listen, I appreciate you hooking this up, but I have to do it on the front end because I got to be at school because my son is in this play. And my wife had some important meetings at her work, so she was definitely not able to make it. And you can't have your kid in the play and right. No parents.
Right.
So I got to represent. So I had to make sure that I got Anthony at the front end of his interview session time. I was only going to have like 10 or 15 minutes anyway, right, so it wasn't going to take a tremendous amount. Plus, you never know, a guy's running late and all the stuff that goes on if there's technical difficulties. Now, fortunately, school is only like a couple of miles from the house, so it's a quick, quick drive over to the school. So I get him on the Zoom call. We do the call. I wrap up. I got just enough time to get my stuff together. And get out
did
of the
you,
house.
Did you let Anthony Joshua in on this, that there was a little time crunch, or you let it go?
I never brought that up.
Okay.
Yeah, he doesn't, I'm not going to, he doesn't give a shit about that. I mean, he's a nice guy and he might have been interested.
Right.
But the Zone folks were aware of my predicament. So I wanted to take care of the interview. I wanted to do it, but I said to him in the original email, we were kind of going back and forth. I said, listen, I cannot miss this one. Like, I've missed other things. I've been away on birthdays and I've been away on, Father's Day and shit like that. But I can't miss the play if my wife's not there.
Okay, so hold on. I've been in this predicament myself. My line always jokingly is, I do not want to be in divorce court on Tuesday or on Monday. So I got to make sure that I'm back.
Happy life.
Absolutely. So I was aware of this scenario. And I'm like, look, if we miss the interview with Anthony Joshua for the podcast, as much as you want to write about it on your Substack, you cannot have the wrath of Mrs. Rayfield at the other end and a disappointed little guy because he wants somebody there for the play. So I was in the corner of, if we got to bag the interview, be there for the play. And I specifically said to you, unless, of course, young Rayfield is playing a tree in the play, because it's an elementary school play, and he's only standing there. Because you could get there at any point when he's being the tree, even after the interview, and get a picture and get some video of him being the tree. To which you said to me, he's not playing the tree. He's doing what in the play?
He actually had three parts scattered throughout the play, which lasted like a total of like half an hour.
Okay.
He played a $5 bill.
That is outstanding.
Having a back and forth with the other young lady who was playing Abraham Lincoln. So you can imagine the back and forth there.
Okay. So then he played Abe as the $5 bill. Now, wait a minute. This begs the question, homemade costume or costume provided by the school? Does he look like an actual $5 bill?
It's a $5 bill held over his face. So it was made by like the props people and their people that were
he's
making the stuff.
$5 bill. This is fantastic. Keep going.
Yes. A lot of funny back and forth lines, anyway, then later in the play, he is a piano keyboard with the black paper taped to his back and he's kneeling down and another one of the kids is playing his back and he's got to sing and he's making the noise of the piano when the person is playing the keyboard. It's ridiculous.
This is tremendous.
And then later he is playing the tennis ball and had some very funny. He was the ham of the play. He was the one making the jokes. And
I'm going to say right now, I have not seen this play. I have not seen video, but young Rayfield has to be nominated for a local Tony Award. This has to have versatility alone. $5 bill, keyboard, tennis ball. This is a command performance as elementary school plays go.
I must
That's
say,
three
though,
roles.
For a play that was before his play, I sat through the kindergartners and through second grade play. They were horrible, but they're little. They didn't know what the hell they're doing.
Of course.
But the kids in my son's play, they were in that play were kids from grades three. My son's in grade four, was grades three through six. Mm-hmm. And those kids did a tremendous job considering.
Yes.
So the bottom line was, and then we can move on to what people are actually wanting to hear. I got the interview done. No harm, no foul. It came out well. They'll hear it in a minute on the podcast. I made the play. Watched my son perform. He was hilarious. All was good. So we got the interview done, and we got the play knocked out. My wife was not mad. My son was not mad, and all is good with the world.
That is tremendous, and compliment him again for the versatility as an actor. I mean, there are some big-time actors that pull off different performances in comedies or dramas or action films, but, I mean, you got to have some chops in the acting profession to be a $5 bill, like, a keyboard, and a tennis ball.
There's, you know, 5 days in the working week, I guess, and it just so happened that in the 1 hour that I am doing an interview with Joshua and my kids in the play, they're like combined together, and it's like, you know, you think you could plan things out, but you just take care of business, and we did it.
And we will hear that interview coming up in a few moments. All right, let's dive in, because we have been talking about this fight coming up. We've been interviewing David Benavidez in advance, as you did. Great job with that. There's no love lost between these guys. Again, Plant, a former world champion at 168. Canelo took the belt off of him on a TKO, giving him his first career loss. He's had a fight since then where he did not look great. Okay, he didn't look great at all, but then he landed a booming punch for a knockout. Benavidez, meanwhile, has had the WBC version of the belt and lost it two different times off the scale. All right, now has the interim version. All right, here we are. It is coming Saturday night in Las Vegas. Give me more.
Well, two times he had the title. One was at the scale. The other was because he tested positive for cocaine, which he chalked up to a youthful indiscretion, apologized, and hopefully he's got his stuff together. But this is a good fight. This is a very good fight. This is maybe not the greatest fight of all time, but I think people who are going to tune in and check it out, they're probably going to get their money's worth. There's, like you said, terrible bad blood between these guys. You know, I asked Benavidez, and people can listen to it on the podcast, you know, what's the root of the bad blood? Like, you know, you guys are, I've interviewed and dealt with both of those guys over their careers. They're pretty nice guys, pretty chill guys. You know, Caleb's a little high strung at times, but not bad people at all, in my opinion. And, you know, and they didn't really know each other. So what's the issue? And Benavidez is like, look, it's like you go to school the first day and there's that kid that you just know you don't like. And that's sort of like the way that he feels about playing, and it's vice versa. And they just want to tear each other up. And Benavidez is a punishing puncher. And with a good chin, and Plant has a guy that can box well, but he's if he needs to, he'll stand in there and fight you the way he did at times against Canelo. And so the styles seem to mesh well. There's a lot at stake in terms of putting their let's say flag in the sand as to who's the next best guy in the weight class besides the undisputed champion, which is Canelo. Caleb Plant is, you know, would like to get a rematch if it's at all possible. Winning this fight would go a long way to making that at least something to think about, even though I don't know if there's going to be a big public movement for that kind of fight. But the winner will be the WBC's interim champion, which would, in essence, make him the mandatory in that organization. David holds that interim belt at the moment. And Benavidez, you know, as he said to me and he said to others, he wants to fight Canelo. That's, you know, he can't make him do it, but he can force the issue and make it as, you know, put the pressure on. And the way he can do that is by looking good and scoring a win against Caleb Plant in their Showtime pay-per-view fight Saturday. MGM Grand Garden Arena, you know, one of the great locations for boxing in the world. I've covered probably close to 100 fights there. Unfortunately, not there for this one. I'll be watching, and it's just a first-class matchup. It's what else can you say? It's two of the best fighters besides Canelo in the division with contrasting styles, with great records, as you mentioned. Benavidez is undefeated. He is 26-0 with 23 knockouts. Caleb Plant just has the one loss against Canelo, with, you know, for all the marbles in the weight class. And they both, Benavidez and Plant, have scored victories by stoppage against Anthony Durrell, who held the WBC title in the 168-pound weight class twice. And, you know, Benavidez put a good beating on him for a while, stopped him on cuts. And Plant, of course, as you mentioned, in October on the undercard of the Deontay Wilder-Robert Helenius fight, which I did attend, in a horrible, horrible, garbage, shit fight. Made us all forget that, except for me, because he scored one of the most spectacular one-punch knockouts ever with just one shot, I believe, the ninth round, and just knocked him out. And then you know, proceeded to irritate a lot of people by the way he acted post that knockout by pretending to shovel dirt on top of Anthony Durrell while Anthony Durrell was still in duress laying on the mat, which was not cool, in my opinion. But anyway, it just shows you these guys are going to have a lot of intensity. I watched the press conference a little while we're taping this on late Thursday afternoon. I watched the press conference. I saw them. They acted professionally during their face-off. I was a little worried they might come to blows, but they'd spend a lot of time jawing at each other, but did not touch each other. And they'll save that for Saturday when they will lay hands on each other. But listen, it's again, it's not the big, I know a lot of people are making proclamations like this is, so, you know, somehow one of the biggest, greatest fights of all time and that kind of business. I mean, I'm maybe slightly exaggerating. I don't look at it like that, but you know what? It's a good, excellent matchup between two of the best guys. And we as boxing fans, the one thing that we all want is we want to see the best fight the best. Sometimes we got to pay a little extra for it. So if you want, this is on pay-per-view, fair enough. I mean, I don't love that, but it is what it is. But I'm thrilled about the matchup. I'm excited to watch it Saturday night.
All right, on the undercard, Jesus Ramos and Joey Spencer are the co-feature, and also Chris Colbert is on the card. He has been derailed and suffered a loss, maybe even a couple losses. You can correct me if I'm wrong there before, but
just the one loss.
And Cody Crawley is also on this card. Give me a little more on the undercard here on the pay-per-view, if you would.
Well, sure, the co-feature is interesting because, you know, I personally don't think it belongs as the co-feature. That's just my opinion, but it doesn't detract from the caliber of the matchup. And that's the reason, because you have two younger guys who are in their early 20s who've gotten a lot of television time and attention, but have still not really fought top guys in prospects in Ramos and Spencer. Spencer had, you know, been built up and spent a ton of time fighting, you know, a bunch of hobos on the Fox shows. He has climbed his record to 16-0 with 10 knockouts. He was a tremendous amateur. PBC has thought of him as a great prospect. I've sort of been not of that opinion. I have not really seen a lot from Spencer. I'm not saying he's bad or anything, but I don't see, like, maybe what they see, that here's a future world champion in waiting. I need to see a lot more before I'm going to be on that bandwagon. In terms of Jesus Ramos, he is the nephew of Abel Ramos, who was also on this card fighting against Crowley. But Jesus Ramos, Spencer and Ramos are both 22 years old. They're both at the beginning phases of their career. But Jesus Ramos was on my top prospect list at the end of 2022. He is an outstanding prospect, 19-0 with 15 knockouts. He's coming off a win against Luke Santa Maria, who was a guy that scored some upsets. He looked sharp in that fight, even though he went the distance. But he's beaten, like, for example, Brian Mendoza, who's now going to be fighting against Sebastian Vandora on a Showtime main event coming up. He beat him, and he did so pretty handily. That was not a complicated fight for him. And Mendoza, that was like his only second loss, and I hadn't lost for a long time. That's a good win for Ramos at that stage of his career. He beat him when he was like 20 years old or 21 years old when he beat him, you know. So it's a good matchup. I view Ramos as the clear favorite, but it's the kind of fight where you're putting these two guys who are supposed to be future challengers or champions or what have you, taking each other on. So good matchup in the co-feature. You mentioned about Chris Colbert. He just has the one defeat. He's a New York kid, primetime they call him. He's 16-1. He's got the 6 knockouts. His situation was he was the mandatory challenger. He had won the interim title of the WBA. And remember, when they eliminated all of their interim titles, thank God, to sort of somewhat compensate those guys that had interim belts, they installed him as the mandatory challenger. So he was supposed to be a mandatory, but he wasn't going to get the title fight for a little while. So he put the mandatory position at stake, and he took on Hector Luis Garcia, who was undefeated and an Olympian, but was a heavy underdog, and he took him apart. He didn't just win the fight. This is back in February of last year on Showtime. He knocked him down, and he won a clear-as-day decision, and that's what propelled Hector Luis Garcia into his world title fight, where he won the belt and then went on to fight and lose against Gervonta Davis. So Colbert hasn't fought since then. He's been out of the ring now 13 months. He's coming back to fight Jose Valenzuela, who was also at one time considered a really superior prospect. He took a loss in his last fight, a third-round knockout against Edwin De Los Santos. That was a big surprise. And so he's looking to regain his position as a prospect by winning this fight. Colbert is looking to reestablish himself after his own defeat. And again, crossroads-ish kind of fight. Not, you know, they're both younger guys, but the loser is going to be in a big, tough spot, and the winner is absolutely going to regain some of that luster that they had prior to their problems, let's say. And that's one of the other fights on the card. And you mentioned about Cody Crowley and Abel Ramos. They're fighting in a WBC welterweight eliminator. And that belt, who knows what's going to happen, because Errol Spence perhaps may be moving up in weight. We'll see what happens. But the winner of that fight is going to position themselves to fight for the WBC welterweight title, be it a vacant title or, you know, get an opportunity. And Crowley, he's exciting. He's a Canadian fighter. You know, he's a southpaw. He's got a great pressure style, 21-0. You know, he's been on Showtime before on undercards with PBC. And Ramos, you know, what can you say about Ramos? He's fought everybody. He had a good, solid fight. He's got a bunch of losses, but he fought Santa Maria also, who scored the upset against him. He has a very close split loss, split decision to Ordenez Ugas when they were taking they were fighting each other for what was then the vacant WBA title in the welterweight division. But, you know, he's a good fighter, and he's very experienced. So, look, the undercard is not populated by big names. What it is populated by is three televised fights that are all on paper, not walkover blowout matches where there should be good quality competition in these undercard fights.
The conversation continues in a moment. First, a couple of words about our friends at PPV.com. They've got the David Benavidez bout with Caleb Plant coming this Saturday night from Las Vegas. And you can get a hold of all of it with PPV.com without a subscription. No long-term commitment. Just watch all of the action as Benavidez defends his 168-pound WBC interim title against the former IBF world champion Plant. Get the undercard fights as well. Some unique features, too. It's the most interactive way to watch the pay-per-view, including our own Abe Gonzalez, along with Michael Woods of NYFights.com. They've got running commentary throughout the comments section and the video section, along with the fights that you'll see on PPV.com. Again, if you're in the U.S. or Canada, you can watch Benavidez Plant in the pay-per-view from Las Vegas Saturday night without a long-term commitment or subscription. Just use PPV.com. That's PPV.com to watch all the action as Benavidez and Plant square off coming Saturday night. Again, PPV.com. Fair enough. And again, it's a pay-per-view. And we will see what happens, especially with the main event. But I mean, again, there are a couple of names here on the undercard as well. It just occurred to me as one other thing too. This is the first time while we mix March Madness with boxing, this is the first time that the NCAA has allowed the prominent regional final to go to the Final Four in college basketball to be in Las Vegas. We don't know who the teams are that are playing Saturday, but they're going to be playing right on the strip at the T-Mobile Arena in and around the same time that the pay-per-view is going on, not the main event. They'll be done before the main event, more than likely. Something always going on in Vegas, whether it's shows, whether it's games. You know, the Raiders now play there, boxing, whatever. It's going to be a big Saturday.
And listen, if you're
Vegas
watching the basketball game, I mean, and I've done this, as many of us have, you know, when the big fights are at the T-Mobile, you know, most of the people stay at the MGM because that's the host hotel. Mm-hmm. That's where they have the media room. That's where the fighters are. That's where all the activities are, typically weigh-ins and press conferences, et cetera. I mean, and you can easily walk from the MGM to the T-Mobile. Mm-hmm. So, and if it's really too hot out in Las Vegas, which sometimes it is, you just cut through the New York casino and it takes you right there in front of the plaza in front of the T-Mobile. So if you're a basketball fan and you catch the games, maybe when you're done, it's not too late to take a short little walk or a tab or whatever and get your butt over to the MGM to catch the fights.
Go catch the fights for what's going up. Again, Anthony Joshua conversation in a few moments. You're also interested in the ESPN Top Rank show with Jose Ramirez headlining from Fresno, California. Let's talk about that for a second before we hear from the former unified heavyweight champion. All right, so this is also coming Saturday night in the preview mode.
Well, I can't say I'm that interested. I mean, you're putting words in my mouth on that one.
Okay. Listen, we're bringing it up on the preview. How about that for a buildup? We're bringing it up.
So Jose Ramirez is an excellent fighter, former United States Olympian, former unified title holder in the junior welterweight division. In 2021, had the big showdown with Josh Taylor. He had two belts. Ramirez had two belts. They were fighting for undisputed status. And Josh Taylor came over from Scotland, and he beat Jose Ramirez in Las Vegas and unified all four titles. Super close fight. Josh Taylor did score two knockdowns against Ramirez. Without the knockdowns, it's a 114-114 fight because Ramirez lost 114-112 across the board. Super close fight. He has had one fight since then, a less than spectacular performance against Jose Pedraza, but a win nonetheless in the Save March Center in Fresno. Now he goes back to the Save March Center in Fresno, which is right outside of his hometown. And so it's going to be obviously a big Jose Ramirez house, a big crowd. I've covered a fight there. They're nuts about this kid. I knew how big of a deal he was in the Fresno area when I walked into the hotel, and there was one of those big cardboard life-size cutouts of him in the lobby welcoming, you know, for some sponsorship that he had locally. In any event, so no problem with Jose Ramirez fighting and doing a fight at a hometown arena. The problem in my mind is he's fighting Richard Comey, who's a good fighter. I'm not knocking Richard Comey. He's been a lightweight champion. He's, you know, he's lost his title by knockout a couple years ago against Teofimo Lopez. He's coming off the draw against Pedraza in a fight that took place this past summer. He has a loss by decision, although one-sided ass-kicking from Vasily Lomachenko. I mean, basically, when he's fought the best guys, he's lost. Teofimo Lopez, Vasily Lomachenko, the Pedraza fight could have gone either way. You know, and besides that, he had a pretty good run, but he wasn't fighting top guys. But so the matchup itself is not like a terrible matchup. I mean, but what pissed me off about it was that Ramirez, and this is not Comey's fault, by the way. I'd have no problem with Comey taking this fight if he was offered the opportunity, is that Jose Ramirez should be fighting for the WBC title against the champion Regis Prograis, because that title was vacant. Regis got the opportunity, or I take that back. The title was vacant, and Ramirez was ordered to fight Jose Zepeda last fall, and Ramirez said, you know what, I'm going to take a pass on that. He used his point was, I'm getting married, we're planning the wedding, I'm not going to be ready, I need the time. Okay, you know what, I have no problem with that. If that's truly what's going on, you know, take care of your personal life. You've made a lot of money.
But
Prograis is the next in line. So he fights Zepeda this past November. He scored the knockout. Yep. He gets the vacant WBC title. And now when Ramirez gave up the chance to fight for the vacant title against Zepeda, the BC said, you'll be next for the winner of the vacant title, whether it's Zepeda, who he had a win over as champion, even though it was awfully close and it could have gone either way, or you'll fight, you know, Prograis. That'll be the order if Prograis wins the fight. So, of course, Prograis wins. The WBC does what they said they would do. They order Prograis versus Ramirez. And I'm not sure. I mean, I like Jose Ramirez. He's the nicest kid. He's charitable. He's a hell of a fighter. You know, there's zero bad to say about this young man. And his manager, Rick Merigian, is a little bit of a crazy nut job, but I love the guy. He does his thing. You know, like what other boxing manager isn't? He works his ass off for his fighters. You know, all respect to Rick. I'll tip my hat. But they had the opportunity to fight him, Prograis, for the title, which is what they said they wanted. Him and Prograis was a fight that was supposed to happen a few years ago, but it was maneuvered. So Ramirez would fight for the title, vacant title against Amir Imam and not Prograis, who ended up going into the World Boxing Super Series. And then they ducked the Prograis fight. And I don't use that word often. And anybody that has ever listened to me or read me, I don't do that. There's no other way to describe it but a duck, because they were unhappy with the percentage that they were going to get, which they know the WBC rules. And I forget what the exact percentage was, but they wanted 10% more. They gave up an opportunity to fight for the world title against a top fighter in what would be a very fan-friendly, exciting fight that would do a big crowd, I'm sure, and good ratings as well.
A significantly more important fight than this fight he's fighting now, by the way, to make your point even more.
So instead, they passed on that fight, and they're taking on a retread, essentially, in Richard Comey. I guarantee you that whatever Jose Ramirez's money is, it may be excellent, but it's not. It wouldn't be the same as if he's fighting for the title against Ramirez. And it's just a disappointment. So, look, they're both, you know, Comey and Ramirez, good dudes, good fighters. But the matchup pisses me off because I don't think it's a great matchup. And he should have been fighting Regis. And that's my story. And I'm sticking to it. And good luck to him. And hopefully they'll get that fight on down the road. But it's really pathetic that you would walk away from a world title shot over 10%. And by the way, let me say, he walked away over 10%. 10% was what the mandated split was on a purse bid. They didn't have to do a purse bid. They never even tried to negotiate with the Prograis team to see what they could come up with. The Prograis people are not, you know, insane with their money. They're not Tyson Fury, which we'll get to. So they never even made the attempt to have a negotiation.
All right. And so now we have what we have. Again, ESPN will televise Saturday night as well from Fresno. Sanicia Estrada is also in the co-feature defending her unified strawweight titles. And the rest of that card goes on Saturday.
Let me correct you about one thing.
Yes, go ahead.
Sanicia Estrada, she is in a unification fight, not a defensive
fight. She's in the unification fight. I thought she already had both. So she's fighting for the second title with Tina Ruprecht. And that is the co-feature fight scheduled for 10 two-minute rounds coming on Saturday in that one. So there you go for the top rank card. Okay. Without further delay, as we've been mentioning, play notwithstanding, excellent job by Young Rayfield. Dan did pull off the interview earlier this week with Anthony Joshua, got a one-on-one opportunity with him to ask some questions. He's fighting Jermaine Franklin in his return bout after losing the rematch with Alexander Usyk back late last summer. So AJ is back, and here is Dan Rayfield with him now.
All right, I'm very honored today to bring into the podcast for an interview. It is the former two-time unified heavyweight champion of the world. It is Anthony Joshua. Anthony, thank you so much for joining me today. I really appreciate it. How have you been?
Thank you for having me. I've been really well. Been in the States, been in your side of your neck of the woods, but I'm back in London now. And what we got now? A week and a bit till our fight?
Yes, sir. All right, let the people know that fight. You will be returning to the ring after about an eight-month layoff since the rematched defeat against Alexander Usyk. You're going to take on Jermaine Franklin, the American, who's coming off a very spirited. A lot of people thought he beat Dillian White in the last game April 1st at the O2 in London, live on DAZN. And I'm glad we can talk about that fight. You mentioned that you were training over here on my side of the pond, and I know you're in the Dallas area training with your new trainer, Derek James. And I wanted to start off and just ask you, what was the in your mind that made you decide that it was time to, after one fight with Robert Garcia, make a switch and go with Derek? And what was it about Derek compared to any of the other guys you may have worked out with that you decided that should be my guy?
Okay, so the situation I found myself in with Garcia, I was actually working with Angel Fernandez. So I'll just break it down quickly. I was with Rob McCracken, just me and Rob. And then we brought in an assistant who can help Rob. Rob's an Olympic coach, right? So, for example, during the Usyk preparations, he was in, I think it was Tokyo, wasn't it, with the Olympics?
Yeah.
So we had to continue my preparation. So we had an assistant coach. So then when I moved on from Rob, it was just me and Angel. And Angel knew that he needed to grow his experience. So I left it in Angel's hands to decide who he felt he would connect with best, because I believe that there's not much point in the athlete making a decision if the trainer doesn't understand and respect the other coach in the room. It's not going to gel. So it's more important for the coaches to be on the same page. And that's going to trickle down in a positive fashion with the athlete. So Angel worked really well with Garcia. And that's what it was. Like, we brought him in for the Usyk fight. And he done a great job, you know. And then after that Usyk fight, it's a new chapter. So I had to go out and now do what was right for me. So I went out for myself now and went coach hunting around America. And I ended up in Dallas, Texas.
So what was it about Derek that stood out to you that made you decide he's my guy, as opposed to any of the other American trainers that you worked out with?
Well, it's hard to say because you take a leap of faith, right? So I'm not going to tell you I knew everything the first day I went with Derek. It was like, yeah, this is the
guy.
But
there's still going to be a chemistry the first time.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah. Or whatever.
So one thing I like is that he's about self-teaching. It's not like this, right? Your hand has to be here and it has to be that way. And that's a bit too high. That not yet. There's perfect. Don't move it. He's more like, put your hand up and make sure you defend that right hand when it's coming. And if you don't defend that right hand, so when you're now sparring or you're training, he's going to throw that and you've got to make sure that you are switched on to defend that yourself. Because in the fight, I can't hear my coach. So my coach can't do all the talking in the gym. He's saying, I need you to also train yourself. And I like that approach. He's instilling like a USB in my brain of boxing information that when he's not there, I can switch that on and all that memory will be instilled in my brain. So I like the approach to training where it's like, I'm going to teach you, but I need you to go home and study and teach yourself. And I like that approach a lot because it helps me grow. It helps me get in my flow. So you become, you're in a flow state then, right? You're just doing your thing and it's just, he's just watching and he's like, yeah, that's everything I'm telling him to do. And he's doing it himself.
So you go into this fight against Jermaine Franklin. As I mentioned, he had a very good performance. A lot of people thought he defeated Dillian White when they fought back this past November. I wondered, was his performance the reason that he, even though he lost, but you're coming off a loss also, so I don't see any issue there. Was that the main reason that you all picked him? And who was it actually makes that final call? Is it Anthony Joshua? Is it your management? Is it Eddie Hearn? Who is it that decided and put the, you know, the final stamp and said, yes, let's make the offer to Jermaine Franklin?
Okay.
Cool. And what do you think of him as a fighter?
Okay. So there's three questions there. First one was Jermaine Franklin. What was the first one that you asked?
What was the main reason that you picked him? That he had such a good...
No, well, it wasn't really because he may have beat Dillian. He lost on the cards, but people say he won. Mm-hmm. Well, for me, it wasn't that. It was a good fight. It was a close fight. It was a good fight. But it looked like, yeah, the word on the streets was Jermaine won. So I was like, that seems a better opponent for now. He's fresh as well.
And who makes that final pick? You, your manager, Eddie, somebody else?
It's a mixture. I'm not going to lie to you. Like, I have the things where I'm solid on, they have their things where they're solid on. We're a good team. We're a good network. So we all sit together and you'll kind of join hands in harmony when it comes to making a final decision. But I'll be real, like, I've got a great team and that's why I employ them, because I'm in the gym half the time. So I'm not, I know what's going on, but I'm not trying to control everything, no.
When you get in the ring with him and you fight the guy, what is it that you would like to show? Because I happen to think that even though maybe you didn't get your hand raised against Usyk in the second fight,
a
much better fight than the first one. So,
and I could have fought better again, but it's all history now. But it's right. Annoying.
So I'm saying, what is it that you'd like to show against Jermaine Franklin? Obviously, you want to win the fight. I don't know. Is it as a knockout paramount to you? Is there something else that you really want to show?
I'll be real, like, and this is no disrespect to Franklin. This is, you're asking me, yeah. So this is nothing to do with Franklin. Like, I feel I need to knock the next X amount of opponents out. Yeah, that's my goal. And also to be a well-rounded fighter. So you have your attack and you have your defense. So I need to also display my attributes when it comes to the attacking, keeping a good shape, and then also defending the shots that are coming back. And my goal is to finish him, well, finish whoever's in the ring with me before the 12th round.
And if you win this fight, as I know you're planning to do, how important is it for you to move on to fight for another world title, or is it more important just to have the biggest fight possible in terms of profile and the money, or is the title the bigger thing for you? Which, is it both?
It's actually a mixture. Like, the title is massive. Like, I can't lie. Everything comes with that. But at the same time, it hurts because I've done that. Yeah, I've won the titles and it still feels like you're still proving yourself. So it's like, oh, fuck it. You know what I mean? Like, look at Mayweather. He's one of the greatest of all time and he doesn't get that credit. So he shows that, shit, I'm just going to make my money. So it's like, it's a balance, right? It comes hand in hand. But I think the title is important for sure. And there's a few like names that like I would like to pursue in the next like 6 to 12 months.
And I mean, the two huge fights for you, it seems to me, title or no title, that are massive, massive boxing events that will make everybody huge amounts of money and potentially could be for a title. That would be you against Deontay Wilder or you against, finally, Tyson Fury. Are those the fights that you like most? And are those, like, you have a preference, I guess, for one or the other?
Well, it seems like Deontay Wilder is more realistic because I just think that the stuff that goes on with Fury is a bit crazy, man. I've been in this situation for a long time. Even with them two, I've been in the same situation. But I just feel like Deontay's coming to a stage in his career where he's like realistic and he needs, not like I just want this fight, I think he needs it. So I think that's more realistic, if I'm honest with you, especially with the place that we're both at in our career. And there's another fight that I'm looking at is Joe Joyce as well.
Oh, that's another great one. And two of those are big British fights. Before you get to those, though, I know you got the fight coming up April 1st. Against Jermaine Franklin. I wish you the best of luck, Anthony, and I couldn't thank you enough for doing this with me today. Danny, appreciate it.
The Usyk and Fury fight going to happen?
Is the Usyk Fury fight going to happen? I mean, it's hanging by a string. It depends who you talk to. I know they got a lot of issues going on. They're trying to work it out. We'll see. I'm probably like you. You hope it does happen, right?
I think it will. I think there's too much. I think the boxing community have put too much pressure on them not to make it happen. If it was left like without pressure from the box community, I think one of the fighters could have wriggled their way out of it. But I think there's just too much pressure from people to make this
fight. They did put a lot of pressure on you guys, for you and Tyson, to make the fight before this fight ended up getting made, and we saw what happened there.
But we and him were supposed to fight, and then he had his Wilder took him to court, didn't he?
No, I'm not talking about that time. I'm talking about before you lined up the Jermaine Franklin fight. There was a lot of conversations.
Man, he gave me like a 15-minute deadline. That's why I didn't have it.
Well, like I said, I hope that everything goes well for you April 1st. I hope that if it does, see you fighting against Fury or Wilder down the road. And But once again, I wish you great luck in the fight, Anthony. Appreciate it.
God bless.
Take care.
All right, well done with that. And again, there you know, there's been some criticism, I guess, of his opponent, as you like to say, and I'm backing you on this. Not every fight is going to be a Hall of Fame fight, no matter who you are. So this is the equivalent of get back in the ring against a competent opponent. Let's see what Anthony Joshua can do. That's me saying that. Any final thought after talking to him as he gets ready to fight next weekend?
Only that I think that my conversation, and again, I could see him because we were on Zoom, so I could sort of see the body language. He knows it's an important fight. He understands that it's not a world championship fight, but he's got to treat it of that level, because without another win, or even perhaps even an impressive win, it's going to stunt his career. And Anthony Joshua wants to make a ton more money and wants to get another chance at the titles. And he named people heard. He mentioned he wants to fight maybe Wilder, Fury. He mentioned Joe Joyce. So those are all three big, huge fights that he could have it potentially down the road. And, you know, I've always liked Anthony Joshua. I think he's a pretty good guy. Always been a gentleman, just a real pleasure, in my opinion, to deal with. And I wish him good luck. Jermaine Franklin, you know, he's getting a great opportunity. April 1st, live on DAZN from London. We'll see what happens. And I'm happy, by the way, that Anthony has been on pay-per-view for most of his recent fights, at least in the UK, whereas here in the United States, he hasn't been pay-per-view. But in England and in the United States, this fight is not a pay-per-view. So there's a bonus for us. If you subscribe to DAZN, it's no extra charge. Thank you.
And they realize, be good to the fans right now with some of this, because he's going to have a bigger fight, more than likely, that will be on pay-per-view, a bigger fight than Jermaine Franklin.
One more thing about that, by the way. You mentioned, like, not every fight's a Hall of Fame fight. When you have two back-to-back losses against Alexander Usyk, who's an elite future Hall of Famer.
Mm-hmm.
And you fought, you know, whatever you think about his performance, where he is in his career, in my opinion, and I don't think it's an outlandish comment, if you take him and stack up his resume, who are the other top heavyweights around right now? Tyson Fury, Alexander Usyk, who beat him twice in his only real heavyweight action other than one other hobo kind of fight. Deontay Wilder, Joe Joyce. The reality is Anthony Joshua still has the best resume of all those heavyweights. Again, my opinion. I don't think that's even up for debate.
When you would put his resume at this point in front of Fury, having beaten Klitschko and Wilder twice, because a lot of people would look at those three wins. I understand the totality of Joshua's overall resume, but those three wins by Fury, I think, might supersede that. It's a good debate, just real quick, that we stumbled into.
But the reality is the Klitschko win came in 2015. That's 7 years ago. So it's a long time. I'm not saying it doesn't count. Fair enough. But it does certainly count. But you also have to take a look at the level of the fights that Joshua had when he was champion and coming up, and the guys that he fought in the order that he fought them in. So even before he was champion, he fought Dillian White and he stopped him way before Tyson Fury did, for example. And then he went on a run where he fought a lot of quality guys. He fought, again, the undefeated. He won the title off Charles Martin. That was not, you know, a great opponent. But when he fought Dominic Brazil, who never maybe amounted to much after this, but at the time he was an undefeated United States Olympian, and he starched him easily. And then he fought a couple fights later, had the rousing fight of the year victory against Vladimir Klitschko, beat him in much more impressive style than Fury. That was a terrible fight between him and Fury. The way I always describe Fury versus Klitschko was one guy that looked bad and one guy who looked worse.
Was fighting Klitschko later in Klitschko's career, two or three years later than when Fury fought him, and Klitschko hadn't fought for at least like a year or whatever.
Why didn't Klitschko fight? Because Tyson Fury was on drugs and kept blowing off the rematch.
Okay.
That's why he was on ice, because he didn't get the rematch.
I understand.
He took apart Carlos Takam. He unified against Joe Parker. He knocked out Alexander Povetkin when Povetkin only had one defeat against Klitschko years earlier. He obviously had the loss to Andy Ruiz, which he avenged in dominating fashion. Then he beat Kubrat Pulev, who was a good contender, was a mandatory. And then the Usyk loss. So I still think that volume-wise, he's got the better resume. Fair enough. You know, if you want to tell me you think it's Fury with two wins over Wilder, you know, that's your prerogative. I disagree.
Speaking of Fury, let's go back to the news here for a moment. And look, we have covered this. You've written about it. We've talked about it. So I want to come at it from two different things. Not surprisingly, the fight now not happening. It's just not realistic for April the 29th. Now, the questions that I have are twofold. Number one, can they get this back on for the summer? What are you hearing? I see you shaking your head at me. And so then the second part is, if they cannot, then what is next for both? Because here's one other factor. All this talk about making Daniel Dubois as the next fight for Usyk, if it's a full ACL tear from last December, he is not going to be ready until later in the summer at the earliest for reconstructive knee surgery. So we're going to have to wait and wait if that's the fight for Usyk. So the twofold, can they get it back on for the summer at some point, Fury and Usyk? And if not, what is next? Give me some more.
All right. So just to back up, everybody knows if they've been following for 2 seconds here, this fight fell apart this week because they couldn't come to an agreement on the terms of a rematch. And it wasn't just terms of a rematch. It was the one specific part of that term. They had agreed on the split if Fury won and Usyk invoked the rematch right. It would be, if the fight was in the UK and Fury was the winner of the first fight, it was going to be a 70-30 split in favor of Fury, the same way it was going to be for the first fight if they were able to get it done. If the fight was in the Middle East where they got a big boatload of money, then the deals that they would get in terms of there wouldn't be a percentage situation, then the Fury camp would go make a deal with the paymasters in Saudi Arabia, and the Usyk camp would go make their own deal also, and they would just take their guarantees from those folks and don't count the other guy's money. Whatever they get, they get. The where the rubber hit the road was, what's the term if Usyk pulls the upset and wins the Fury first fight and the rematch is invoked by Fury and it takes place in the UK? Fury was willing to give Usyk 50-50. Usyk was like, if I win and I'm undisputed and I beat you and I got to come back to your home country, I want the 70-30 that you got in
Amen.
The first fight.
Amen.
So Fury wouldn't budge off of his request. Usyk wouldn't budge off his request. It seems, and I talked to people that were involved in the negotiation that said this was the case. The reason is that Usyk was so ticked off was because he got beat every which way in the first negotiation by giving up what he gave up. And he wasn't going to stand for being beat on everything in the second negotiation and getting beat up. And to me, and it's not just in boxing, it's in life, in any negotiation, any deal you're making. If you're at a bargaining table, your one side can't win every single point of the negotiation. Otherwise, it's not a negotiation. You got to give the other side something to walk away from the table with, to hang their hat on and say they got something that they wanted. So what it came down to was this rematch got blown up, or not the rematch, the fight in general got blown up because of a difference of 20% on a rematch if Usyk pulled the upset and the rematch was in the UK. You see the minutia of that? It's just so preposterous. And they're both, going to make a lot of money in the fight and the rematch if it were to happen. Certainly Usyk wanted the rematch because it was a second bite at the apple, no matter what happens, and he can make money bigger than any place else. And Fury, of course, can make money against pretty much anybody. But the problem, and I thought that Frank Warren, who is the co-promoter of Fury, on TalkSport, which is the big sports radio station in the UK, and I'll give a little plug where I do a hit every Monday night. One of their day shows had on Alexander Krasiak, who is the promoter for Alexander Usyk, to give his side of the story. Then a little while later, they had Frank Warren on to give his side. And then at the end of that, they had Alex and Frank on together. And no hard feeling between those two guys. They're just doing business for their clients. But Frank made a great point. I don't always agree with Frank Warren, but I thought this was I hadn't thought about this. Why are we worrying about a rematch? Because even if there is a rematch, whoever is the winner of the first fight, the rematch will not be for the undisputed title because the sanctioning bodies are going to start to order their mandatories. They've all sort of stood down while letting this situation play out. But if there's a outcome of a first fight and all the belts are hoisted up by one guy and they move to an immediate rematch, then a belt is going to get stripped because of a mandatory that's due. And it wouldn't even be for the undisputed anyway. So let's just do this first fight and we can always do a rematch later. And I agree with that. Rematch clauses are a horrible thing in boxing. I understand it occasionally for maybe certain reasons here and there, but this particular fight, you know what? It's prize fighting. You fight for the prize. You get the money. If the winner gets the belts. And if it's a good enough fight and it's a fight that the public likes and the media likes and it does big business and all those factors, then you can always sit down and like gentlemen and make a second deal. Fair enough. But for this fight to blow up over essentially 20% on one particular scenario of a rematch, it pisses me off. It's a dark day for boxing, and it's just unfortunate because we're right here on the precipice, TJ, of getting the first undisputed champion in the heavyweight division since 1999, when Lennox Lewis defeated Evander Holyfield in their rematch in the three belt era. And so that this fight that had no you know, backs, no blockades from promoters, no blockades from broadcasters. The sanctioning bodies all stood down, and they couldn't get this shit together because they were arguing over a certain number of millions of
dollars. They couldn't get it together for April the 29th. I got that. There's no hope that it can happen in the summer, listen, even with giving Dubois step aside money.
You can.
It's not going to happen. It's done.
You can always pull a rabbit out of a hat. So you never, the same way I say never when the sun goes down the toilet, you never say never that maybe they can come together and get it done. But the Usyk side has been very clear. This fight at 70-30 in Wembley is only on April 29th. They have other obligations. And the WBA has come out in the last week and said, look, we've given you time to tell us you made a deal and you really didn't get it papered in time. So here's the deal. We are going on April 1st to order our mandatory defense. So you got to get your shit together. And they will order on April 1st, unless something changes dramatically. They'll order the Dubois fight. Now, you asked about Dubois and his availability. Mm-hmm. My understanding is that he's not available for April or May, but by June, July, he probably will be able to go. And so it takes time to put these fights together. So there's a good chance that come this summer, if this fight, in fact, is dead, which I believe it is for now, that you'll see Alexander Usyk and Alex Krawczyk said this in various interviews and such, that we'll move on and we'll make our mandatory defenses. And people, you know, Tyson Fury, who made, you know, videos and basically vilified Usyk, you know, go make, you know, a couple dollars to take your mandatory. You know what? Alexander Usyk is my belief is not only about the money. Fury is only about the money, whatever he says. And I don't care what he says. And I'm not saying that in a negative way. You're entitled to be about the money. You're in the hurt business and make as much as you can. But some guys are not only about the money. And Alexander Usyk and his best friend, Vasily Lomachenko, and plenty of other fighters, money is, of course, a huge, huge, important factor. But it is not the only factor for Alexander Usyk. He wanted to be undisputed, and he's not going to give up his belts. And so if he's got to take a certain purse to take a mandatory defense, he'll do that. And if it means he's making a lot less money to fight Daniel Dubois, who he'll butcher, in my opinion, he'll take the lesser money and he'll fight the mandatory. And if it doesn't happen against Dubois, they'll go to the next mandatory, which is the IBF, and that would be Filip Hrgović, which is also a very solid fight. Hrgović was a top amateur, an Olympic medalist, etc., undefeated as a pro, and we'll see. But the fact that Fury and Usyk are not fighting when there's no obstacles other than their own pride and greed, etc., was very, very disappointing.
And you did very well.
A thousand times we didn't know if this was going to happen, and it's not happening.
All right, and you did very well laying that out, and we got to move on. But the bottom line is Tyson Fury's made a ton of money in the last 3 or 4 years in fights, and this should be about
Usyk.
Well, yeah, but I mean, Fury's made more. Fury's made more with those Wilder fights alone in terms of guaranteed money. And at some point, it's got to be about legacy, the four belt thing. That's got to be important too. And this whole thing got blown up because of it. So I agree with you on that. All right. So other news real quick, and then a little bit of nostalgia. The Naoya Inoue Stephen Fulton battle that was scheduled for later this year is now delayed by a couple of months because of an injury to Inoue. The good news is it's not so significant that it takes it out for like a long amount of time. Apparently July, they will be able to fight. That's the latest. Fill us in a little more on what you know.
Yeah. So that they postponed the fight, which is a huge bummer because that was probably one of the best fights, if not the best fight, just a pure fight on the schedule in terms of this, what you expected from the competition and the stakes there. You know, you have Inoue, the pound for pound elite fighter, the three division champion moving up, where he had vacated the undisputed bantamweight title to challenge Stephen Fulton for the unified title at a junior featherweight, where most people have Fulton as the number one fighter in that weight class. On some people, their list, he's moving up in, you know, the borderline top 10 of the pound for pound list. And so it was a great matchup. And unfortunately, Inoue is hurt. Now, when they announced the postponement, Top Rank, which is his American promoter, and when the Japanese folks that promote him announced this, they did not tell you what the injury was. They just said he has a training injury. The fight will be rescheduled on a date to be announced in July. So that was a good thing. Now, I have done my own reporting, and what I am told is that he has a dislocated knuckle on his left hand.
Okay.
So not a super serious injury, but enough that will keep him out until July. I don't know why that was such a big secret. I mean, you knew immediately if they're going to reschedule for July and the fight was in May, that it's not some kind of terrible, you know, long-term injury. I don't know why they kept that such a secret, but when you keep that a secret, the big man's got to go to work and find out what it is. And it is a dislocated knuckle on his left hand.
So this is the reason why you listen to the podcast. This is the reason why you read the Substack. And I guess, you know, some of it is cat and mouse. You don't want the opponent to know. Again, the Japanese culture, they're a little more guarded just in general with not wanting everybody to know everything. But you're right. That's not like we're covering up. Like the Dubois thing, back to that for a second. The fact that he had torn his ACL, that was blockbuster when we finally found that out. And they kept that quiet for like over a month. And then all of a sudden,
but I don't know if it's a full tear.
But even still, that's a serious knee injury, even if it's a partial tear. And what I'm saying is they kept that quiet. And then like a month later, Barry McGuigan kind of let it out like, well, you know, Daniel's going to be on the shelf for a little while because he tore his ACL. Oh, okay. But you're saying dislocated knuckle, and we can probably be back in July for the Monster and Fulton, which we like real quick. Yes.
Yeah. So July, they'll get it back together. And, you know, in the end, it's just going to get postponed by a couple of months. It doesn't detract from the fight. It's not the kind of injury where you're suddenly going to worry if he's going to be able to do the fight. He didn't break his hand. He didn't break his knuckle. It's an injury that happens to boxers, and it just takes a little time to heal, and he should be fine, I would think, based on what I am told. And we'll see him back in July. And so it just gives us a tremendous summer fight to look forward to instead of a tremendous, you know, a spring fight to look forward to. That's how I look at it.
Yeah, the Monster, definitely pound for pound, is one of the guys up there on the list. All right, you've got one more news item because you have learned about a May show as well for Top Rank and Janibek back in the ring as the WBO middleweight champ. Tell us more about what we know.
So Janibek, you know, he's the WBO's middleweight title holder. He's been rebuffed by a lot of people that haven't wanted to fight him. Jaime Munguia went running away from him like there was no tomorrow. Demetrius Andrade moved up and vacated to not fight him. He didn't really look so great in his last fight, but anyway, he is going to fight. And so Top Rank is going to take their May 13th ESPN card to the Stockton Arena in Stockton, California. And it will be Janibek versus Stephen Butler, who is a Canadian fighter who, you know, has got a good record. He has had a chance to fight for a middleweight title in the past when he fought for the secondary WBA belt in Japan a couple of years ago against Ryota Murata, who knocked him out in the fifth round. He has been knocked out in another loss as well. And so, again, not the biggest fight, but it's a chance for Janibek to get into prime time once again and hopefully put on a better performance than he did in his last fight. And that'll be the situation with that. And then, you know, Butler's got another great opportunity. You know, he's being picked here because they think he's going to lose. He is highly ranked in the WBO organization, which is why he qualifies for the belt. You know, the other fight that was ordered for Janibek was the Liam Smith fight, who was the mandatory, which would have been a pretty good fight. But Liam Smith is obligated contractually to do a rematch against Chris Eubank Jr. And I don't think that Liam Smith would have taken the title fight anyway, because the amount of money that he can make in a rematch against Chris Eubank Jr. is obviously going to be far superior to what he can earn if he was fighting Janibek. And he already beat Eubank, and it's just a much bigger fight. And so there's that. And then the other fight on that card, it's a doubleheader world title fight. Top Rank has added the vacant WBO bantamweight title, which is Jason Maloney against Vincent Astrolabio. Not the most well-known name, but he does have a win not that long ago against Guillermo Rigondeaux in a pretty big upset. So there's your doubleheader, May 13th in Stockton on ESPN. Not a terrible card at all.
All right. Fights that are getting scheduled, we love that. One more thing, that is nostalgia, and you're getting nostalgic about Thunder Gotti, Arturo Gotti, and a fight 27 years ago. Significance in it, man, oh man, 27 years ago, 1996. All right, give me something on the nostalgia about Gotti, the legend of Gotti, right? 27 years ago was born.
So Gotti had won the IBF title at junior lightweight. He beat a very good Tracy Harris Patterson to win that title. But he was not that well known to the national public. He was popular maybe in the club show areas in New Jersey that he had been fighting on, originally from Montreal. But where he, in that fight with Tracy Harris Patterson, when he won the title, was on, I can't remember if it was either on HBO or it was on an HBO pay-per-view undercard. But either way, it was seen, you know, by a lot of people on an HBO platform. In any event, now it's come time to make his first title defense. They line up a Spanish fighter, Wilson Rodriguez. Gotti is, you know, the favorite. They're fighting at the Madison Square Garden Theater in New York City. It's the second episode of what at the time was the brand new HBO Boxing After Dark series. And so Boxing After Dark, which became one of the great boxing series in the history of the sport, opened the previous month with one of the most memorable main events ever, which was the fantastic legendary fight between Marco Antonio Barrera and Kennedy McKinney. So now you got a big shoes to fill on an encore. And somehow Gaddy Rodriguez made it two for two because they put on an equally spectacular fight. You had Arturo Gatti, who has got his eye swollen. He's been knocked down. They're going back and forth. And when I say the legend of Gatti started, this is what started the run where Gatti gained the reputation as the comeback action warrior, where he could just pull it out of the fire at any time. He comes back. The doctor, this is a classic scene. Go on YouTube and watch it. It's the stuff out of a movie. His eye is all fucked up and closed, basically. And the doctor goes in the corner, and he's thinking about stopping the fight. He tells Gatti, cover your eye and tell me how many fingers I have up. And Gotti's giving him an argument, and finally he covers the eye, and the doctor holds up the fingers, and Gotti guesses, and he guesses right. And the doctor lets the fight continue. And Gotti goes out there, and he fucking starched Wilson Rodriguez with a left hook. And it was one of the most legendary comebacks you could ever see. I mean, you would be sweating watching it on TV, much less taking part in the fight. And for me, why it's such an important fight, because it was where I discovered Gatti, who became my all-time favorite fighter, as I say all the time. And I was a fan of boxing my whole life, basically. But my interest had waned over the years. Mm-hmm. I mean, I got more into it. This is before I ever had covered a professional fight. I was working at the newspaper in Saratoga Springs. I covered my first fight later in 1996, when that fight happened. But I watched that fight live on HBO, and it helped truly rekindle my fanaticism about boxing when I saw what Gatti did. And that made me an all-time fan. And I've talked to many boxing fans in my encounters with them, either in person when I've gone to fights or back and forth on social media. And a lot of them can pinpoint a specific fight that they watched that turned them from a casual into a diehard. Maybe it was something they watched with their dad or with their grandfather. They went to a closed circuit, or, you know, a family friend invited them over, whatever it was. And they really got turned on to the sport. Or like me, they were a fan of the sport, but it went to the next level when they saw something truly special. And so when I saw Gatti knock out Wilson Rodriguez, that was truly something special. And it took me to the next level of my fanhood. And it wasn't that much longer that for a lot of different reasons, I ended up being the boxing writer at USA Today and having covered, you know, my first professional fight. But if I don't watch the Gatti Rodriguez fight, and I don't think I'm overhyping this, I don't know if I would have ended up being a boxing writer.
It was that good. And now,
and it was that important in my life.
And you, and I love this. And I now need to go back and revisit this because I don't really remember all of it. And you're teasing me well, along with the audience, to go back and watch how this ends. And it got you fired up again. And now here's your career. There you go.
Exactly. And one other thing about that, the Gatti Wilson Rodriguez fight, of course, is the main event and was as memorable as it gets. It overshadows what was a fantastic junior featherweight fight that was in the co-feature, that was the opening televised fight that night on HBO, which was a tremendous fight between Junior Jones, who was a former bantamweight champion and a New York fighter, was a good fan following in New York, fought the veteran former champion also, Orlando Canizales, who was now in the International Boxing Hall of Fame, and they put on a terrific battle in the opening fight, but it gets forgotten about often because the main event was so absolutely sensational.
This is why we love the man for the nostalgia. And I was just thinking this when you were saying this, because we're coming to the culmination of the college basketball season and the tournament and the Final Fours in Houston. All right. But when you were saying this about what ignited you as a fan for boxing, for me, as a 9-year-old little TJ, I'm revealing my age, I became glued with Bird and Magic and the 1979 Final Four. Part of it was Larry Bird hadn't been on TV. The games weren't on TV. You only knew about the legend from reading in Sports Illustrated or reading in the newspaper, and you finally got to see him in the NCAA tournament. And by the way, by the millions, people got hooked on this whole thing known as the college basketball Final Four because of that Bird versus Magic, Magic versus Bird. Magic and Michigan State won the game. And that's what this thing is now mushroomed into, such an event and a multi-billion-dollar tournament and event because of that. And I was thinking of this when you said it too, before we're gone. Shortly after that was the Aaron Pryor Alexis Arguello fight, Orange Bowl in Miami. We have had Barry Tompkins on this podcast, and Barry Tompkins has done a ton of fights, including doing Hagler Hearns, including doing Mike Tyson title fights, Larry Holmes title fights, name them. He still says that is the, for everything that went into it, that is the fight. That is the fight that he remembers for everything that went into it, Arguello and Pryor. And I dare say to you, I became a much more bigger hooked boxing fan, to your point, because of Arguello and Pryor in the Orange Bowl, 81, I believe, if not 82.
82, I believe.
82. That, and so I can identify with what you're talking about with this Gotti fight.
And by the way, Pryor and Arguello, their first fight is one of, again, in my opinion, but I don't think it's a controversial, I think it's a top 5 or 10 fight in the history of boxing.
Or and everything one of our things, that went way, into it, yes. Yeah,
about the Gatti Rodriguez fight, I did a piece about Gatti for a Ring magazine print issue where they were doing a tribute to Gatti and Ward. And my task in that particular issue was rate the top 5 Gatti fights that were not against Mickey Ward.
Right.
You know, because those are special. It's certainly the first one and the third one, obviously. And I ranked the Wilson Rodriguez fight as number one.
Wow.
As the best Gatti fight not against Mickey Ward.
There
and
you
I talked to some people with Gatti, his longtime career-long manager, Pat Lynch, Carl Moretti, who people now know as the vice president of boxing operations for Top Rank. But back at the time, he was with Main Events, which was Arturo's promoter. And the story that Pat has told me is, you know, when Arturo got knocked down, the question was, you know, what were you thinking when you got dropped? Because I believe it was the first time Arturo had ever been on the deck in his career. And Pat will relay the story. I had just bought a fancy, expensive sports car with my last fight purse. And I'm like, shit, there goes the title. There goes my money. There goes the car. Which is what he said that Gatti said he was thinking when he was getting off the floor. Just a great fight.
Love it. All right. So we'll go. I can't believe 27 years ago for Gatti. And there you go. All right. So it began right there, man. This has been a busy show, a ton on it. Again, preview of Benavidez and Caleb Plant. Watch it through our friends at PPV.com. Again, it's a Showtime Premier Boxing Champions pay-per-view, but you don't have to have Showtime. You once again can go to PPV.com and buy the fight. And our guy, Abe Rodriguez and Michael Woods of NYFights.com, they're doing their own interactive chat segment through PPV.com. Ongoing as the fight night is unfolding there in Las Vegas. Going to be a lot of fun with that. Great job with Anthony Joshua, Dan Rayfield. We'll see him next week. Plenty that we previewed. What say we come off the weekend and recap all of this? Whatever happens with Plant, Benavidez, and everything else for this weekend, are you up for that once we're done this weekend?
I'm up for that. We'll get a little bit more into the fights from this coming weekend when we do our BetUS betting show on Friday afternoon at 1 o'clock Eastern time.
Look at you.
On the BetUS platforms, on Twitter, on YouTube. We got it.
Listen to you. You're Mr. Tease now. That's well done. We'll be talking about these, and we did not really mention here, but we'll be talking about on the show Lawrence O'Coley in the UK and Manchester defending the WBO cruiserweight title. We'll talk about that fight and the other ones 1 Eastern time, and you did a great job with the plug. BetUS platforms live at 1 Eastern time, or watch it later on where we handicap the fights. For now, we are good. We've got a Fight Freaks Unite recap coming on this podcast feed right after we're done off the weekend, but you've been listening to the Big Fight Weekend Preview. Bye.